All right, so as we get started tonight, I wanted to, before we really keep going in what we're reading in Joshua chapter 10, I wanted to pause for a minute and start by talking briefly about how I'm approaching reading Joshua and how I think we should approach reading Joshua and everything else in the Bible, because we talked a little bit last week. I think it was brought up in a question. I think it was Marcia. It was a great question about something that we were reading in Joshua chapter 9, which it seemed like, Marcia thought, might have, should make us think of other things that come up later in the Bible, especially in regards to the Gibeonites. And there have been several times so far in the book when I suggested something like that. For example, with the crossing of the Jordan River and the Ark of the Covenant going before the people into the Jordan. And I said that I think there's something there that shows back up again later when we get way down the line and start talking about Jesus in Hebrews chapter 12 being the one who goes before us. That might seem like a stretch, is the reason that we're talking about this for a minute. But I think it's important when we're reading a book like Joshua, it'll definitely be important when we get to Judges. Because when we talk about reading things in context, there are a couple different things we can mean by that. One is just the foundational observation that it can be very dangerous to pick a random verse out of a random spot in the Bible and spout it out, assuming that we really understand what it's trying to say without its context, its surrounding, the surrounding passage, what the author is actually trying to say in that group of verses, which may not be exactly what you think a single verse says by itself when it's viewed in isolation. And so when we talk about reading in context, often that's what we're talking about. We're talking about what I would call immediate context, not just a single verse, but the five verses around it. That's a kind of context that's important. But there's other kinds of context that are important. Another kind of slightly broader context that I would say is similarly important is the idea of local context. In other words, if I pick out a random verse in Galatians and I read it, in order to really understand what that verse is saying, I should have an idea of what Paul in Galatians is saying. Local context meaning the area where that verse appears, not just the verse in front of it and the verse before it, but the context of the book that it's found in, perhaps. And that's the kind of stuff we get into when we talk about authorship and audience and local culture at the time. All of those things kind of play into this idea of local context, understanding what a verse means by understanding a little something about where it's found, what book it's in, what genre it is, who wrote it, who they wrote it to, why they wrote it. All those things help us understand things. Sometimes that's where we stop. And the problem with that is the collection, the Bible, I should say, is not just a random assortment of random books that happen to be put together and given to us. The Bible is, at its whole, a giant narrative that one single author has put together, made up of a lot of different books written by different authors in different genres and to different audiences at different points in time. But all of them fit within the scriptural narrative context that is the Bible. And when we're reading a book, we get this, right? When you're reading a book, you have a narrative arc that rises and falls, and you have conflict, and you have all those sorts of things. And if you read something in a book, and then you finish the book, later on you might catch echoes where that early point gets brought back up, gets reintroduced. There are echoes of that earlier thing. And so when we're reading a book like Joshua, it is important, I think, to understand something about the authorship. Who wrote it? Why it was written? When it was written? The immediate local context of the book. But it's also, I would say, equally important not to stop there, but to realize that Joshua is given to us as part of a larger story. And there are inevitably going to be things that come up here that are then echoed later by the divine author in different parts of the story. An example of why it's bad to stop with local context. Like sometimes we might read a book of the New Testament and say, try to understand who Paul was writing to with Galatians and what specific conflict might have been going on that he was trying to answer in that book, and that helps us understand Paul's arguments. And it does. But of course, Paul is writing to the Galatians. God is not just writing to the Galatians. God is writing to a broader audience, and he purposefully includes things that are not confined to the audience of the human author that he uses to write those words. When we read Psalm 22, David is writing a psalm about his enemies surrounding him and him feeling isolated. David wrote that psalm. David had no idea that that psalm was really about Jesus, but it is. And when we see Jesus quoting that psalm on the cross, we can go back and we can look at Psalm 22 and we can realize that it was about a whole lot more than David realized when he wrote it. And I think that's a good example of why it's good for us to read a book like Joshua with our eyes open to the broader narrative of Scripture, because we will see and should see things in here that ring a bell because they come back up. There are theological themes in here that are important to pick out because they remind us of other things, important things that come later. And there will, I think, be an example of that here in chapter 10. Okay. So in Joshua chapter 10, we got through about verse 15. And in the part of the chapter that begins in verse 16, we read about the battle that has just taken place in the first part of chapter 10. Israel seems to win it completely. There's a pretty total victory, but they're chasing the enemy army quite a distance, as we'll look at a map again in a few minutes. And then beginning in verse 16 through 21, we read this little episode where, first of all, the five kings of the enemy coalition, they run off and they hide in a cave. And Joshua is told where they're hiding. And he essentially tells his men to set up a guard on the cave, to roll a large stone in front of it, to seal them off for a time until the Israelites can finish chasing down their enemies and winning the battle, and then we'll come back and we'll take care of these kings. A couple things to point out in this section. One is that in verse 22, there's an interesting phrase that's only found one other time in the Old Testament. Excuse me, it's in verse 21. That after Israel finishes this, what seems like a pretty total victory, at least the battle in the plain, they strike all of their enemies with a great blow until they're wiped out, verse 20, and then the remnant that remains of the enemy armies flees into their cities. In verse 21, it says, they returned safe to Joshua at the camp at Makkada, and not a man moved his tongue against any of the people of Israel. This is a kind of interesting Hebrew idiom that's only found one other time in the whole Old Testament. Literally, what it seems to mean is nobody growled at them. Nobody snarled at them. The only other time it's found is in Exodus chapter 11 and verse 7 in the plagues of Egypt. I think it's during the seventh plague. I'll have to go back and check that carefully. Oh, no, it's not the final plague. God is telling his people, telling Moses in Exodus 11 in verse 7, that he's going to bring a final plague upon the people of Egypt. He's going to kill every firstborn in the land, except for the people of Israel's, only the Egyptians. And he says in Exodus 11:7, not a dog will growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. In other words, the safety of the people of Israel was going to be so complete as this avenging angel comes through and kills the firstborn of all of the Egyptians. Israel is going to be so safe that not even a dog is going to growl at them during the night. And God says, that's how I'm going to make the distinction between who is mine and who is not. And that's the idiom that shows back up here in Joshua chapter 10 as Israel is wiping out its enemies. And it seems to suggest in a kind of similar way, all the people return safe in verse 21. Israel wins so completely. Not only is nobody lost, not only is nobody harmed, but essentially, as they return back to their camp, no one even dares snarl at them. It's an interesting turn of phrase, and it's a rare one, so worth pointing out. In verses 20 through 22, we get an interesting scene where Joshua has his men bring out the enemy kings, and they come out, and he says to all the men of Israel and the chiefs of the men of war in verse 25, come near and put your feet on the necks of these kings. So we have these five enemy kings who are placed on the ground, and the leaders of Israel come and they, quite literally it seems, put their feet on the necks of these kings. It's kind of a ritual humiliation, a representation of Israel's victory and power over these royal rebels. And Joshua uses it to give courage to the people. He says in verse 25, as his chiefs are standing there with their necks on the kings, he says in verse 25, do not be afraid or dismayed, but be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. So Joshua uses this as an opportunity to encourage the people, to remind them that God is fighting for them and that the victory they are seeing today will be consistent as they go through the rest of the conquest. We're going to read over and over that they do to the kings they encounter like they did to these kings. And Joshua tells the people, don't be afraid, but be strong and courageous. Just like God encouraged Joshua at the beginning of the chapter, now Joshua encourages the people. I want you to notice in verses 26 through 27 the fate of these rebel kings. So after Joshua has his men stand on the necks of the kings, he strikes them and puts them to death and hangs them on five trees. And they hang on the trees until evening, but at the time of the going down of the sun, Joshua commanded, and they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves, and they set large stones against the mouth of the cave, which remain to this very day. A couple of detail things to notice about that. One is, it ends to this very day. Again, we have a kind of monument, a kind of memorial that is set up here. In this case, it's the grave of these five kings who rebelled against God's rule. And there's a memorial of sorts. There are stones that remain on the tomb, marking the spot, even to the day that Joshua is written. Also, verse 27, it seems, the way Joshua does this comes from the commandment that most of us are probably familiar with in Deuteronomy chapter 21 that said, if you hang someone on a tree, what must you do? Not leave him overnight. If somebody's hanging from a tree, take him down before the setting of the sun, because cursed is the one who hangs on a tree. Now, there's something interesting here. First of all, this sets up a pattern. This is the same fate that the king of Ai met in chapter 8 in verse 29. The king of Ai was hung on a tree until evening, and then they took his body down and covered it up with stones. Here, five rebel kings meet this fate in Joshua chapter 10, in verse 26. As we go throughout the chapter, we're going to see pretty much every king, most of the kings that we run into that Joshua fights again, several of them are mentioned that they follow the same pattern. He treats them as he did the previous king, who was treated the same way that the king at Ai or the king at Jericho was treated. So it's a pattern that sets up. This seems to be, in Joshua's eyes or in God's eyes, a fitting way for rebel kings to die. But of course, we're reading Joshua chapter 10, and we know the story. We know the whole story, right? And so we know that eventually, as we've pointed out before, eventually in Israelite history, there's going to come another conquest of sorts, led by another Joshua of sorts. A king who's going to come in and he's going to carry out a conquest in which all of his enemies are defeated and subjected, even as we read in places like 1 Corinthians, let's see, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verses 24 and 25, which kind of echoes the language of Psalm 18 and Psalm 110 that talk about Jesus' enemies being put underneath his feet, that God has subjected Jesus' enemies and placed them under his feet, which might seem like a similar image to the one that we see here in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 24. And so there's going to be another Joshua who leads another conquest, who defeats all of his enemies, puts them under his feet. But there's a difference in that future story. And the difference has some interesting connections to what happens here in this chapter, doesn't it? The way that Joshua is going to accomplish his victory is by himself being the one to hang on a tree and be thrown into a cave that is covered with a large stone that's rolled over the front and has a guard set upon it. There's something, I think, that we should think about as we read a story like this, and we see the way that rebel kings are killed. And we notice that there's a remarkable similarity to the way that a king who does not rebel will eventually be killed. If we think about Joshua chapter 10 and we think about our place in this story, you know, sometimes we like to put ourselves in Old Testament stories. Like if we were in the story of David and Goliath, I would obviously be David, right? I would be the one facing the giant. No, more than likely, we would all be the terrified children of Israel who are standing on the sidelines afraid to fight. Jesus is David. But in this story, we're not the children of Israel. We are, at best, the Gibeonites, who deserve to be destroyed and yet somehow find grace. Or we're among the five kings, or should have met their fate. That's the picture of the fate that befits those who refuse to accept God's righteous rule and instead rebel against him. And yet, we aren't those five kings. We don't die as they died because someone else, Joshua, stepped in and put himself in our place. There's also something interesting, I think, just in the fact that the principal, the ringleader of this rebellion is King of Jerusalem, whose name means righteous Lord. And eventually, of course, there will be a greater king of Jerusalem whose name is not ironic at all. It is really the righteous Lord. Okay, back to local Joshua. There's a confusing timeline here, which you may have noticed as you were reading through. By the way, the reason for all of those passages, 1 Corinthians 15 is where the image of Jesus' enemies being put under his feet. Acts chapter 5 is where his death is described as hanging on a tree. Deuteronomy 21 is the commands, is the passage about people who hang on a tree, and cursed is the one who hangs on a tree. And Mark chapter 16 is the resurrection scene where they come to the tomb expecting to find someone there, and instead they find the stone rolled away, and the tomb is empty. This tomb in Joshua 10, the stone remains against it to this very day. It's a reminder of God's victory because God's enemies still lie within it. Jesus' tomb, of course, is a reminder of God's victory because it is empty, because the stone is not still there. But anyway, I wanted to explain what those passages all were there for. There's a confusing timeline in this chapter, and it's debatable. How we're supposed to read things as playing out. But of course, we have this extended divine day in verses 12 through 14, where Joshua asks the Lord and God makes the sun stand still in some sense. He extends the light of the day. And in verse 13, it says, "It did not hurry to set for about a whole day. There has been no day like it before or since when the Lord heeded the voice of a man." So the sun, at the very least it seems, does not hurry to set for a longer time than is normal. It doesn't set when it would normally set. Instead, if we take everything here literally, which we may well want to do, it extends the day by the length of another day. So we essentially get 2 days of daylight, or perhaps just 24 full hours of daylight instead of less. It's worth pointing out, I think, because it'll come up later in the chapter, that the Hebrew word for day is not always a literal day. Depending on how you read Genesis chapter 1, you may have very strong opinions about whether it should be a literal day or not a literal day. For example, even in the early chapters of Genesis, I think it's Genesis chapter 2, where this same word is used to describe the day in which God created the heavens and the earth. So it's not a single specific 24-hour period, it's the time in which God created the heavens and the earth. Talking about that creative period, those 7 individual days, as one day. But this word is used all over the Old Testament to talk about lots of things other than specific 24-hour periods. It can mean a time or a period or even years. So at the very least, I think, it's saying that the sun did not hurry to set for the complete time, or the whole time, or the perfect time, or that could be a whole day, a literal, specific 24-hour day. I tend to think that it's a bit longer than that, actually, because of some things that come up in the rest of the chapter. Of course, there are lots of people who read this and think that it was less time than that, that it might have just been the amount of time that it takes a solar eclipse or something. You know, try to find a naturalistic explanation. But I don't think that makes sense. I especially don't think it makes sense in light of the rest of the chapter. For example, in verse 28, it says, after it gives us the whole death of the kings, that whole aftermath, in verse 28, it tells us that Joshua captured Makkedah on that day. and struck it with its king with the edge of the sword, devoted it to destruction. And so it seems, I think the most natural reading of the timeline, if we're going to try to construct a timeline, is that during this same day, this time or this day in which the light is divinely extended, Joshua and his men not only finish the battle in the field, but while they're chasing the people down, while the kings are hiding in a cave, they press on to Makkedah and they strike it with the edge of the sword. They complete the destruction there, and then perhaps they come back to the camp at Makkedah, and that's when the kings are executed. That's a possibility. You saw in verse 15 what seems like a kind of concluding statement, that after this battle, Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. But then in verse 16, we suddenly find ourselves back at Makkedah. Now, that's a long distance. And so, if we take the timeline as it is, seems to be directly presented in the text, then we get Israel kind of bouncing back and forth. They make this long chase all the way down to Makkedah, which, do I have this? Okay, so, I had to switch it back to red. Camp at Gilgal, perhaps around here. They come over to the battle at Gibeon, which is already quite a trek. It took them 3 days the first time that they made that journey, although it doesn't seem like it necessarily had to take that long. So we're at Gibeon when the battle begins. We chase all the way down here to Makkedah. And what chapter 10, verse 15 describes is that after everything is over, they go back to Gilgal. Okay, the question is, what happens before everything is over and they go back to Gilgal? Look ahead to chapter 10 and verse 43. Verses 42 and 43. Something interesting happens. In chapter 10, in verses 42 through 43, after we get what is basically the description of the entire southern campaign and all five cities that Joshua conquers in that campaign, we read, "And Joshua captured all these kings and their land at one time," we'll talk about that phrase in a second, "because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal." Notice two things that are almost verbatim the same as chapter 10 and verses 14 and 15. The first is the mention that the Lord fought for Israel, which in chapter 14 is tied to this divinely extended day. "There has been no day like it before or since when the Lord heeded the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel." In chapter 10, verse 42, we get that repeated, "the Lord fought for Israel." And then in verse 43, we read the same as what we read in verse 15, that Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp at Gilgal. So let's look at what comes in between. In verses 29 through 39, really, we get a description of the cities that are taken in this southern region. They're grouped pretty closely together, but they seem to together make up the bulk of strongholds in the southern portion of Canaan. And so first it says in verse 29, something that might seem significant. We read in verse 28, for example, that on that same day, or on that day, Joshua went ahead and captured Makkedah. And then in verse 29, we read that they passed on from Makkedah to Libna. Now, if I'm trying to construct a timeline here, it would feel a little bit unnatural to think that after verse 28 and before verse 29, suddenly there's a trip back to Gilgal and back. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because if Joshua and all Israel passed on from sacking Makkedah and press on to Libna, that seems like a strange way to skip over a trip back to camp at Gilgal and then another return journey. But there's an emphasis in this second half of chapter 10 on how quickly things happen, remarkably quickly. So they take Libna in verses 29 through 30, and We'll talk a little bit more in detail about each of these in a moment, but I'll just kind of skate over them as we talk through the timeline concept. They capture Libna in verses 29 through 30. Then they pass on from Libna in verse 31 to Lachish. And in verse 32, it says something interesting that you could read one of two ways. It says, the Lord gave Lachish into the hand of Israel, and he captured it on the second day and struck it with the edge of the sword and every person in it as he had done to Libna. So there are two ways the commentators read this. And this is really the whole point of the last 5 minutes. One is, simply to say, they went up against Lachish, and it took them a couple days of lying in siege against it, but on the second day of their siege, they took Lachish. Then we get down to verse 35, and after Lachish, they go to Eglon, and it says in verse 35 that they captured it on that day, and they devoted it in every person in it to destruction that day. That's the same phrase in verse 35 that's repeated twice, the same phrase as we saw in verse 28. So, let me tell you what I think, and it might not be right, but I think it is. Or at least I think it has a very good possibility of being right. It seems to me that basically what happens in the first half of the chapter is all described as taking place on this divinely extended day. The Lord makes the light extend, he makes the sun stand still, and while that happens, they win the battle, they press on and they destroy Makkedah, and at some point in that time at Makkedah, with the camp at Makkedah, they take care of the five enemy kings. You notice in verse 27 that the detail is given to us that they take the kings down at the going down of the sun, right? So however long this day lasted, it was long enough for them to win the battle in the field, take the city of Makkedah and destroy it, and, well, actually, they don't destroy Makkedah, they just kill everyone in it. Take the city of Makkedah and then kill the enemy kings. And then it seems to me that before the concluding statement that they go back to Gilgal, that we read in verse 15, we get all of this other stuff from verses 29 through 30, or 29 through 39, that while they're in this area, they go ahead and they're going to take Libna and Lachish and Eglon and Debir and Hebron before Debir, actually, but they take these five cities and possibly Jarmuth too, although it's not mentioned specifically. And all of those seem to happen in remarkably quick order. For example, in verse 42, we read that phrase that Joshua captured all these kings and their land at one time, or literally in a step. Joshua captured all of these cities in a step. So the way that some, including myself, would read verses 32 and 35 is that all five of these cities from verses 29 through 43 are essentially taken on the second day, the day after this divinely extended day. It doesn't really matter, honestly, but there is a contrast with what we're going to read in verse 11 with the conquest that takes place in the north, where there's going to be a point made in verse 18 that northern conquest takes a long time, whereas the narrative emphasis in chapter 10 seems to be on how quickly things fall. Joshua and the people, with the strength of the Lord, just keep going, and God gives them city after city after city until they take this whole southern region, and then they return to their camp at Gilgal. Now there's a pattern between all of the cities that they take. You'll notice some similar things that come up in several of them, although it doesn't say the exact same thing about every single city. There is a recurring pattern of the things that it describes. First of all, there's an emphasis on the Lord giving the first three cities into their hands. Makkedah, Libna, and Lachish, it all mentions the Lord giving them into their hands. There's also an emphasis on what they do to their kings. They do to the king at Makkedah the same that they had done to the king at Jericho, which is the same that they did to the king at Ai, which is the same that they did to these five kings in chapter 10. They do this in Libna too, at the end of verse 30, the same thing to that king. And also I think it mentions both the kings at Hebron and Libna and Debir in verse 39. So again, there's a pattern with the way that they deal with the kings. There's a pattern with the way that Joshua deals with the people. Every city that they conquer, in some form or another, it mentions the completeness of the slaughter. Every person in it, he left none remaining in Libna, in Lachish, every person in it, in 34, in Eglon, every person in it is devoted to destruction. That phrase, devoted to destruction, comes up again, and it's going to be a repeated theme in chapters 10 and 11. Devoted to destruction, none remaining in Hebron, and in Debir, devoted to destruction, every person in it, none remaining. And in the kind of summary statement in verses 40 through 43, it says, again, they devoted to destruction all that breathed. So there's a completeness to this slaughter. In the cities that they take, they kill everybody. We won't spend long on this. There's a little bit of difficulty here, because when we get later in Joshua, there are going to be a couple points at which it tells us that not everybody has been killed or driven out, even in some of these same areas. We'll get to chapter 13, and we'll read that the Philistine areas still need to be driven out. We'll get to chapter 14, and it'll seem that Hebron needs to be taken back again when Caleb goes to receive his inheritance. So there's a little bit of difficulty here, because chapter 10 seems to present the southern conquest as being total, being complete. It's over. Everybody's dead when they leave the southern area. But later on, we read that that's really not the case. Either some people have moved back in and they've kind of taken over some of these areas, because what is emphasized in chapter 10 is not that Israel goes in and they kill people and then they settle. They just go in, they take the cities, and then they get back out of town and go back up north to Gilgal. And so there may well be the kind of, you know, somebody drives out the evil spirits and then doesn't put anything in its place, and more evil spirits come back in. So perhaps the Canaanites just kind of come back in from the outskirts of the area and take back some of these cities. But there are three Hebrew words that are kind of important in Joshua and in Judges. One of them is the word that keeps coming up, the idea of capture or take, lakad. Capturing or taking something, that's a word that's emphasized here in chapter 10. Every city Joshua captures, he takes it. And he strikes it or he smites it, that word nachash. But there's a word that's not in this chapter at all. And that's the word that we're going to read a lot of as we get later into Joshua and in the first few chapters of Judges, which is the word yarash, which is the word for dispossess. When we get to early chapters in Joshua, that's going to say over and over, six or seven of the tribes, it's going to say they did not dispossess the people. In other words, they went in and they took the cities and they struck the people with the edge of the sword, but they did not drive them out. That's the dispossess or drive out or even possess. The other kind of direction of the verb is also used. And so that seems to be what happens here in chapter 10. They go in and they take the strong points. They kill everybody in the strong points as they're commanded. But then they go back up north and they're going to go carry out the conquest in the northern part of the land. And at some point in that interim period, before the tribes start to come down to actually settle, to actually take possession, some of the Canaanite people start creeping back in. And so Jerusalem is going to have to be captured again. Hebron is going to have to be captured again. The Anakim, which we're going to read about in chapter 11, there are going to be Anakim in the region of Judah that have to be killed and driven out. So the reason that that even might be important as to notice as we read here is because chapter 10 ends on a very positive kind of final note. And it might seem like everything is done in the south part of the land of Canaan at the end of chapter 10. Unfortunately, it's really not. And we're going to, as we get farther in the story, we'll realize that. Okay. Any comments on anything through chapter 10? I've been talking for a long time. Go ahead, Bob.
We might actually talk that way today in a poetic way. You know, I might say back in the day when I was dating Brenda, you know it wasn't, I might say back in the day when I was dating Brenda and then we got married, mm-hmm. you know it wasn't one day. It was a period
right.
of time.
Period right.
of time. So perhaps.
Yes,
perhaps
definitely.
That's, it's a poetic way of referring to a period of time.
Yeah, I think it could well be. I don't necessarily think I think you have to be consistent. Either you read verse 13 as a single, as it being extended by basically a 24-hour period, and then you get later in the chapter and you need to read all those battles as taking place essentially in another 24-hour period, or you read both of them a little bit more figuratively and you realize that however long the divinely extended day lasted, then everything else takes place in a kind of swift fashion, but it's a little bit, but the description of it being on that day is a little bit more figurative. I don't know if that makes sense. Any other comments? Please.
When you were referring to Genesis, the promises in Genesis, the Garden of Eden, to Revelation, the mm-hmm. Garden of God, and fulfillment. In some way, you should be looking for them being fulfilled in Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Anything else? Anybody? All right. So we're not going to get through all of chapter 11 tonight. I'll mention this. This will be the last thing that we point out tonight. We'll finish with the end of chapter 10. The summary statement in verse 41 actually kind of extends the territory that it says Joshua has captured at this point. This map doesn't show it. This is for a different purpose, but it is. If you have a map in the back of your Bible, perhaps you can see Gaza and Kadesh Barnea are both on this map. Gaza is kind of the far western marker of the area that Israel has kind of pacified at this point, and it describes them all the way south as Kadesh Barnea. Now they haven't traveled nearly that far south. At least not that we've read about specifically. There aren't a lot of cities that far south. You can see it's kind of a wilderness desert area. What is interesting about that is that it was at Kadesh Barnea in Deuteronomy chapter 1 and in Numbers chapter 14. The people of Israel were at Kadesh Barnea when God told them to go into the land at the first point, at the first place. And so from Kadesh Barnea, God told them to go into the land. They didn't want to, and so God said, forget about it. We're going to go into the wilderness, and you're all going to die. And they decided, hey, at this point, maybe we should go in. But they go, in Numbers chapter 14, they try to enter the land of Canaan without God at their side, and they go up kind of this way, and somewhere up here in the hill country, very much the same area where Joshua is fighting here in Joshua chapter 10, Israel fights against the Canaanites in Numbers 14 and is defeated. And in both, I think it's Numbers 14 and Deuteronomy 1, It describes them being chased back down by the Canaanites as far down as Hormah. The reason that that's helpful, maybe, is that at this point in Joshua 10, now we see that Joshua has captured or pacified all of this area of Canaan, even down as far as Kadesh Barnea, where the children of Israel were encamped at the first, a generation before. And now they have fought the Canaanites in the exact area where their parents' generation was defeated and had to flee. And we'll read in chapter 11 that they've captured and killed the king of Hormah, the city where the people of Israel were chased the generation before. So again, we kind of get this reversal of what happened a generation ago, that Joshua and the people of Israel in this generation have been successful where their parents were unsuccessful. All right, thanks everybody. We will finish chapter 11 next week.